Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Today on the program, we've got hate crimes, medical marijuana, a new school superintendent, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper is with us. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Tribune Justice reporter Jennifer Dobner joins us again. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, good morning.
And senior political reporter Robert Gerke is with us as well. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone from the nation's capital, Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Tommy, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
And you are welcome to join us as well with the stories on your mind this week. You can put comments on the website, sltrib.com. You can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, or you can call us, 801-355-TALK. 801-355-8255 is that number. Tommy, I'll start with you. Justice Antonin Scalia, a passionate conservative on the U.S. Supreme Court, died this week, touching off a sharply partisan debate about whether the president should nominate his replacement or allow his successor to. What does this whole thing look like from inside the Beltway?
You know, it's a fascinating time to see something like this. For example, Justice Scalia is lying in repose state at the Supreme Court today. You know, obviously a somber occasion where people were lining up just drove by a little while ago, lining up, you know, to try to pay their respects to the Associate Justice who died in Texas, I believe, on Saturday, Sunday. And, you know, outside of those walls, though, is this partisan debate, especially heating up in the presidential arena, that because it's a presidential year, the president shouldn't nominate a successor for that seat and leave the court with only eight justices. Obviously, that's coming from the Republican side, including Utah's own Senators Hatch and Mike Lee, and all the Republican presidential candidates are saying the same. On the opposite, the White House Democrats are saying, hey, if you didn't notice, President Obama is still the president, and he has a constitutional duty to nominate someone.
You noticed that the Republicans, Utah Republicans, are firmly in the wait camp. And you reported this week that this is a reversal for Senator Orrin Hatch, who has previously strongly advocated for pushing ahead with nominations.
Yeah, in fact, we have to clarify here. These were conversations Hatch was having about district court judges and circuit court judges, not necessarily about the Supreme Court. But let me give you a quote from 2004. This is Orrin Hatch speaking July 2004 when, you know, George W. Bush was in a tight race with John Kerry. Quote, "The fact is we have to try to keep moving judges as much as we can because it's not the country that's concerned, not politics." In talking to Hatch this week, he says, you know, this is a much different time. The presidential race is very toxic. You know, the country is very divided, and we should let the people speak before we get to the point where the president's going to nominate someone. Senator Mike Lee, as well, is in that camp, saying that he thinks we should wait as well. That Republicans aren't inclined to even hold hearings on a presidential appointment to the Supreme Court, and that's the consequence of election. That Obama's still the president, but Republicans are still in control of the Senate.
Hmm. Justice Scalia, as you noted, is lying in repose at the high court today. How are Utah officials remembering him and his legacy?
You know, several of them, you know, obviously worked with him for a long time. I think, you know, Senator Hatch was there when he was confirmed to the court and considered him, you know, a friend and, you know, a luminary for the conservative causes. Senator Lee was a clerk at the Supreme Court for Justice Alito and is now a senator, and so obviously knew him very well. I have to say, I actually have had a few interactions with Justice Scalia over time. Usually, you know, at a little reception for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you'd be able to grab a few moments to talk to the justice about what we refer to the highest court in the land, which is a basketball court above the Supreme Court,
nice.
Which is always just a fun and easy thing to talk about when you don't want to talk about politics. but, you know, it is something that as soon as the funeral, the wake is over, This is going to heat right back up, and we assume that President Obama is going to nominate someone, and then the Senate is going to block that person.
And, of course, this all figures into the presidential race. You wrote this week that Utahns are on the campaign trail for some of the candidates. Can you tell us where the congressional delegation has been?
Sure. So mainly it's been Congressman Jason Chaffetz has been traveling quite a bit to stump for Marco Rubio. He's been to New Hampshire. He's been to Nevada. He's been to South Carolina. Congressman Chris Stewart also has been campaigning, mainly doing some stuff in New Hampshire as well, and some in Nevada, which is obviously going to the polls, excuse me, caucusing on Saturday. Mia Love has done a little bit. Representative Rob Bishop hasn't done as much, but is waiting to be a, you know, kind of unofficial advisor on public lands issues. Senator Orrin Hatch is backing Jeb Bush. And Mike Lee, who has been this, in this tough spot because he has now only two people, two of his very close friends in the race, but he flew down to South Carolina this week to stump for both Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. So you got to, he's trying to like, you know, be very careful about not endorsing one or the other, but help out both of his friends.
Are we going to see any candidates in Utah?
I think at some point as we get closer, but, you know, everyone's really focused on South Carolina right now, Nevada, and then Super Tuesday. But Utah's coming up, I believe, March 22nd. Gertie could probably double-check me on that one. But, you know, we'll see maybe some surrogates starting to fly into Utah and maybe some of the candidates, because if this race is as high as we think it is, every single delegate's going to matter.
Mm. We do have a special guest coming to Utah next week, Vice President Joe Biden. What's the occasion?
Yes, in fact, so this is part of the administration's push. They call it the cancer moonshot. President Obama talked about this in the State of the Union and has tasked Biden, his vice president, to kind of lead up the charge to help galvanize the medical community, the research community, into finding a cure for cancer and other diseases, saying, you know, we're not sure how the federal government can help, and maybe helping is getting out of the way, clearing up some of that red tape, but also using, you know, some money. They're looking for $1 billion in the president's budget to go towards, you know, cancer research and research into finding ways to curtail or end the diseases that are affecting the country. So Vice President Biden is going to be flying into Salt Lake City a week from today. And he's going to be visiting Huntsman Cancer Institute. We assume there'll be, you know, some kind of a roundtable discussion. We'll have some, you know, video and some reporters trailing the vice president there. And then he's off in Toulon. He's going to jet for California after that. But it's always nice to have, you know, such a high-profile person visit Salt Lake City.
And I suppose Huntsman, this is an opportunity for them to show off a little bit. What's on their brag list?
You know, one of the things that the Huntsman Cancer Institute has and none of the other cancer institutes in America have is this genetic database, the Utah population database. Because Utah is known for, and Mormons specifically are known for, the ability to trace their genealogy back, you know, generations and generations, you can see in this database how things have affected them, who might have had what disease at what time, what grandfather might have had that. They can maybe help trace what genes may cause certain diseases or lend them to be more susceptible to other diseases. So that's something they're really looking forward to highlight. It's also the only cancer institute in the Intermountain West that is a National Cancer Institute designated. So they really do have a lot to show off, and they're very excited for the opportunity for the national spotlight.
Lots to look forward to next week. Tommy, we'll let you get back to your reporting duties. Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington correspondent and president of the National Press Club. Tommy, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And again, you can join us, 801-355-TALK is that number. Let's turn to state politics. Lots happening on Utah's Capitol Hill. In an unusually blunt critique yesterday, Utah State Senator Steve Urquhart blasted his own church at a press conference that was focused on his hate crimes bill. And Jennifer Dobner, you've been reporting on this. What did he say?
On Wednesday, we should back up a day and say that the church issued a statement about cautioning lawmakers against passing any new laws that would what they said alter the balance that was achieved in 2015 through the historic compromise that brought non-discrimination law statewide that protects LGBT persons in housing and employment. Their statement did not specifically say, you know, Senator so-and-so, we don't like your bill, or we do like, you know, Representative so-and-so's bill. But it was just a broad sort of general statement. But it was issued, as I understand it, in response to questions from media about Senate Bill 107, which is the hate crimes legislation that would toughen state hate crimes laws. And Senator Steve Urquhart, a Republican from St. George who's sponsoring the hate crimes bill, pushed back against that statement yesterday, saying it effectively kills his legislation and leaves people in Utah without adequate protections against bias crimes.
Again, the LDS Church statement does not comment on this bill specifically, urges caution. What other bills sort of fall in the category that they're worried about?
Well, there's a, we assume, because we don't know, but there is an adoption bill that would, you know, clear the way for LGBT persons to adopt. That had been previously, you know, illegal in Utah, but now that marriage is equal for everyone, there are corrections going on in the law. There is presumably a religious liberty bill. It's a bill file that we can't read right now from Representative LeVar Christensen, which some have said would provide an affirmative defense for discrimination based on your religious beliefs. So, and the LDS Church statement says, you know, there are things coming from both ends of the spectrum that were concerning. So when they speak, and Robert can help me here, they don't speak publicly often, but when they do, it's generally seen as a strong message, and a bill can rise or fall on what they say.
Mm-hmm. Robert?
Right. I mean, it's notable that, you know, on the topics that they have spoken out on in the past few years, alcohol reform, they've spoken against that, and there hasn't been alcohol reform. They spoke in favor of the hate crimes legislation, and we got anti-discrimination legislation. We got anti-discrimination legislation. They spoke against the medical marijuana bill that Mark Madsen's sponsoring. It looks like that bill's probably dead. So. And they spoke in favor of immigration reform in the state, and we got immigration reform. So they have a pretty good batting average, you could say. And so I think the fact that this hate crimes statement came out when it did, and I think Senator Urquhart acknowledged yesterday that it may very well be the demise of his bill. And they were hopeful that it came out of committee on a 5-1 vote. Mm-hmm. They had pretty broad support for it going into the Senate vote. They were confident that they had the votes lined up in the Senate, and I think we can kind of wait and see exactly how much sway the church has over the membership in the Senate. Mm-hmm.
So one thing that is interesting about this is that in the past, the church has given non-opposition to hate crimes legislation. Lawmakers have not been eager to pass anything historically because the bills have included this list of classifications: race, religion, gender. And sexual orientation, which people have opposed. The lawmakers have opposed. They don't like this idea of creating special rights or privileges. The bill wouldn't actually do that, but that's the position that has been taken. Historically, I think it was 2003 was the first time the church issued a statement saying, we don't oppose the bill as drafted. They didn't say we love it, but they didn't say don't pass it. Hmm. And that included the issue of sexual orientation, which Urquhart has said to me in the past week still remains a barrier for him. Despite advances in LGBT rights nationally and locally with non-discrimination.
Well, Senator Urquhart really did not hold back.
No, he did not. He said, it's not us that are upsetting the balance that was created last year. It's our church. He apologized to minority racial groups. He apologized to minority religious groups. And he apologized to Mormons because he said the thing that hate crimes laws... The existing hate crimes law, I should say, is ineffective. All it does is provide a sentencing enhancement at the misdemeanor level. He's looking to expand that and to put in law what 44 other states have, which are these classifications. And he's saying a hate crime terrorizes a whole group of people, no matter who it is, whether you're a Mormon or a black person or a woman. These kinds of crimes do more than just affect the specific victim. They affect a broad community. His argument is that's the whole reason Mormons are in Utah. They were hate crimed out of every other place that they lived. And, you know, they should really rush to make sure that everyone has these protections. And he apologized to them yesterday, and he said apparently the price of justice is giving equal footing and equal rights to the LGBT community.
Is he counting noses? I mean, does he know how many votes have switched since Wednesday?
No, you know, we asked that question yesterday and nobody really could answer it. The statement came out late Wednesday. They were sort of scrambling and, in fact, didn't even respond on the first day. So I don't know at this stage. But as Robert has said, you know, the church has a good batting average when they speak. It remains to be seen if it'll advance or not. It's on the board in the Senate. I understood it probably would not get a vote, maybe earliest late next week, because there's a resolution that goes with it that's really for prosecutors and the court system. So he was waiting for that to catch up so they could do it all at once. So, but we'll see if it goes anywhere at all.
A comment from Twitter from Pete Bush. Notice that all opposition to the hate crimes bill is coming from people with majority privileged status. Sounds like there's some frustration out there. The coalition that Senator Urquhart has built around this hate crimes bill is quite expansive.
There's more than 30 people on the in the coalition, or 30 groups in the coalition right now. It's churches of all stripes. It's LGBT people. It's various ethnic groups, the ACLU, the NAACP. So broad support. Who knows if they can be effective at continuing to lobby? There was so much pride, I would say, in last year's compromise and the passage of non-discrimination and the types of things that we were hearing from senators and representatives on the floor as the bill was being debated and passed were so such different sounding rhetoric about equality. I wonder if they really will slide backwards, or if they'll just push forward. We won't know till it happens.
Well, I think I think they'll probably continue pushing for a vote. I think they were, as I mentioned, pretty confident that they had the votes in the Senate. It's going to be pretty close right now. When we saw, when they came out against the medical marijuana bill, and they came out much stronger against Senator Madsen's medical marijuana bill than they did on the hate crimes legislation, but. Senator Madsen said he lost one or two votes on that, and that makes a difference in it, when you're trying to get to 15, you lose two, you're kind of down in a hole. So I think we'll see it come out. It is interesting, as Jennifer mentioned, that one of the largest groups that will be protected under this bill are the Mormons, and as she mentioned in her story today, I think
20%
of hate crimes are committed against religious people, and it's second only, I believe, to race.
That's
and
correct.
So the church would benefit from this, presumably. We've seen crimes, attacks on churches, vandalism of churches,
arson
against churches, LDS churches in this state. And those are the types of things that would be covered under hate crimes legislation were it to pass.
Mm. Well, Senator Steve Urquhart, as well as Derek Monson of the conservative Sutherland Institute, which opposes the bill, will be my guests on Trib Talk today. That's the Tribune daily online video chat at 12:15. You can check that out at sltrib.com. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We will be right back after another break.
On your Utah Public Radio community calendar.
With a nice variety of great songs, both new and old, Cafe Ibis of Logan hosts New Folk Revival, February 21st, featuring a soothing mixture of rich vocal harmony, a dash of humor, and tasteful instrumentation. The Division of Services for the Blind and Visually Impaired of Salt Lake hosts Irish Night, a family event to help send visually impaired students to Camp Abilities Ireland, featuring a student exchange sports program, live Irish dancing, music of the Salt Lake Scott Pipe Band, and more. Event begins February 26th at 7 p.m. Habitat for Humanity of Southwest Utah is hosting their second annual Masquerade Ball, February 27th in St. George. The event will be held at Hilton Garden Inn from 6 to 10 p.m. To view events or to submit your own, visit our community calendar page at upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here in studio with Robert Gerke, Jennifer Dobner, and Rachel Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune. And again, if you want to join our conversation about the week's news, you can tweet to the hashtag TribTalk, comment online at sltrib.com, or you can call us. 801-355-TALK is that number. Before the break, we talked a little bit about medical marijuana, but some transitions in the debate this week. Again, LDS Church issuing a statement that effectively drained a lot of support among lawmakers. So the advocates have a new strategy. What's the plan?
Right. Well, given the church's their second statement in a week opposing the bill, I think they've kind of seen the writing on the wall. They were always going to have a hard time getting the bill through the House, even if they got the votes in the Senate. So they're turning to the next, their really only option that's left for them, and that is to try to run a ballot initiative. And put it, you gather enough signatures and put it on the 2016 ballot. They announced this week that they had lined up some prominent financial backers, including Patrick Byrne from Overstock, Bruce Bastian, who's a tech millionaire, and also Scott Bannister, I believe is his name, from he's a tech guy out of San Francisco who put a lot of money into Colorado's ballot initiatives. And if you look at it across the country, 23 states right now have a medical marijuana and the District of Columbia, and more than half of them have gotten there through a ballot initiative. So this is not unusual. The problem they're facing right now is that they're starting very late in the process. They've got until April 15th to get, and they've got all of these steps they've got to take. They've got to get the language of the initiative drafted. They've got to submit it for a fiscal and constitutional review by the Lieutenant Governor's Office and the Attorney General. They've got to hold 7 town hall meetings in various regions around the state. And then they've got to go out and actually start gathering the signatures. And they need about 102,000 signatures to get, and they've got to be dispersed around the state geographically. And they've got to do all of that by April 15th. It's a huge lift. If they are able to do it, it's going to take a tremendous amount of money. And then, assuming they can get there, then they've got to run a campaign to get this passed in the November election. So it's a daunting task, but they feel like this is what they're left with at this point. And in a way, they kind of are, because if the church, with the church's opposition, if this isn't able to get through the legislature this year, Senator Madsen, who's the sponsor of the bill, that they support is going to be retiring at the end of the year. So they lose a vote there and they lose their sponsor, Senator Urquhart, who we talked about, who supported the bill when it was in committee and supported it last year on the floor, I believe. He's going to be retiring as well. So they're going to be down a few votes in the Senate. And again, the House is still a struggle for them this year and likely will be next year, too. So this is sort of when you run out of options, you kind of take the long shot. And that's what they're going to be doing here.
Well, supporters, I suppose, are taking heart in the fact that public sentiment seems to be on their side. At least that's what several polls have indicated, including one by the Salt Lake Tribune and the Hinckley Institute of Politics. Right.
Yeah, that's right. The polling that we did earlier in the year. Now, again, this was before the LDS Church's statement, but 61% of Utahns supported this, including 48% of Mormons. 44% opposed it. So it was fairly evenly split on the LDS population. But yeah, 61% of Utahns supported a legal medical marijuana program. Actually, UtahPolicy.com and Dan Jones did a poll. That came out, the timing of it, they were in the field when the church's statement came out, so it's hard to tell, but they had 64%. So it's possible that, you know, and we'll have to wait and see what the future polling shows, but it's possible that the church's statement didn't actually move the needle that much. In fact, it looks like it may have moved it the other way. But, you know, so there is support for it, and there's a lot of energy for it. I mean, people who are supporting the medical marijuana movement are very passionate about it. And they do have some money behind it. You know, 100,000 signatures is hard to get. They're counting on it needing at least $1 million to get them there. But they think they've got the financial backing, at least, that they need to get there.
So we've been talking primarily about one of the medical marijuana bills,
right.
Senator Mark Mattson's bill. There is another bill.
Right.
How's that faring in all of this?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of support for that bill, frankly, because it is an incremental step. I mean, they're taking baby steps on this. The Senate Bill 89, the Evan Vickers, Brad Daugh bill, would sort of legalize these CBD oils, cannabidol oils that are extracts that don't contain any THC, which is the concern for a lot of people. The THC is what gives you the high from marijuana, and they don't want that being a more common thing. So the CBD oils have been shown useful for people with epilepsy and some various other ailments. There's some research that's going on them. And their thinking is like, well, this is an easy first step that we can take. We can say we've done something, and maybe lay the groundwork for something else down the road if we need to expand it. But they want to be cautious again, and that caution is one of the words that the LDS Church used in their statement. They encouraged caution on this issue, and so the church does not oppose the Vickers Daw bill. And both of the bills are going to be coming up for a vote today in about an hour, actually 45 minutes. We're going to start the debate on those. And so we'll see where the votes are. But I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, that the Vickers Daw bill is more palatable, especially to some of those who have concerns about expanding full, as they call it, whole plant marijuana into the state.
So it's sort of a case of beat the clock for the Mattson supporters. Again, mm-hmm. What's the timeline that they have to meet?
April 15th is the deadline 15th. For them to get all of those steps accomplished.
Wow. Well, we'll see how that shakes out.
And just sort of if you look at the last initiative drive that we had, it was the Count My Vote initiative, and it took them several months. It took them 5 or 6 months to go out and get those votes, and they had considerable financial backing as well. So it's a huge uphill task for them to get there.
I don't know. It seems medical marijuana is a little easier to translate than election reform.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on to another subject. State Public School Superintendent Brad Smith announced this week that he is stepping down. And this comes after a leave of absence that he took. Rachel, what are his reasons?
Well, he has been absent for a while with a chronic but not life-threatening health issues, which we haven't gotten any more specifics than that. But in his resignation, he doesn't actually mention his health issues. He says that I am no longer able to make a positive contribution to public education. A lot of people are wondering if that means that he has not been able to get along with the board, if the board has some issues, and many teachers, of course, are pleased by this resignation because he sort of set himself out as an enemy of teachers last year when he compared them to spoiled children.
Do we know if this resignation is on his own terms or was he asked to leave?
And that's what we do not know. He sent his letter directly to the chairman of the board, the education board. But we don't know if that was requested or if he did that on his own.
Smith, of course, was an unconventional and a controversial choice from the outset, right?
Yeah. He's a lawyer. He had really no education background. He was picked to lead the Ogden School District and came up against a lot of opposition there, too. A lot of teachers said he, you know, was cutting programs. He wasn't listening. He was running it like a business and not like an education district.
But that unconventional approach certainly appealed to some.
Yes, you know, there's some schisms in education and what that should look like these days.
This is a hard position to fill, apparently.
Yeah, he was the fourth superintendent in 5 years. And now Sidney Dixon was the acting director while he was on his medical leave. And now she's the interim superintendent. And she comes with a lot of support. She does have an education background. They're going to be doing a national search again. But I think a lot of people's assumption is that she'll stick around.
Any other reaction from the education establishment? I mean, you said that school board members issued a statement. Teachers, presumably elated that he's leaving?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the comments on that story, it is joy. And then I'm sure that there were, high fives happening in the teachers' lounges around the state.
I want to turn to another education-related story. Our colleague Benjamin Wood reported on some really startling testimony about abuse allegations surrounding a facility for troubled kids. Rachel, tell us about it.
The Utah Boys Ranch was around for decades. It's a private facility for troubled youths. You know, the parents need some help with their discipline. That changed its name to Westridge Academy in 2005, and there have been a lot of allegations that that abuse happens here. That it's sort of, you know, you send your troubled kids there, and the ways that they get whipped into shape are not exactly kind. And they are looking to expand with a charter school, which would be a publicly funded charter school called Eagle Summit, that would serve the youths at its correctional facility and also sort of recruit other children from around the valley who, you know, also are in need of a little bit extra tough love. And when they went before the charter board with this application, some former students came and said, you know, we were students here and we were mistreated. They were very violent. They were, you know, abusing kids as young as 6 or 7. There was
pinning kids down.
Pinning kids down, yeah, like holding them down with chairs, forcing. I guess a student, according to these students, took his own life, and then they were forced to all look at the corpse. I mean, it's pretty extreme allegations. And the response of the charter board was sort of like, well, you know, troubled youths, what do you expect when they talk? And they voted to go ahead and make it a charter school. And an unusual move, the state school board overturned that and said, you know, we're not going to approve this yet. We want to look into this. And interestingly enough, the Westridge folks didn't really exactly refute these allegations. They just said, well, we're going to be doing some new stuff at Eagle Summit, and it's not going to be the same people, so no worries.
Mm. The Tribune does have a request in for some public records, some police records, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, what's going to happen next?
Yeah, well, they can resubmit that application next month. So we'll see what the school board says this time.
Okay, keep following it. If you didn't see the story, it is fascinating and very troubling. SLTrib.com is where you can find that. Jennifer Dobner, while we're talking about justice issues, can you update us on the Mark Shurtleff trial? A couple things happened this week.
Yeah, on their face, seemingly small things, a hearing to debate evidence access was canceled. So that seems like not a big deal, turn of the screw type development. However, the evidence at issue is the contents of the FBI investigation that was conducted of Shurtleff and also of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow in advance of criminal charges being filed. Davis County Prosecutor Troy Rawlings has been trying to get these documents since late last summer. He believes they are critical to his ability to prosecute Shurtleff. And he also has a thing called a Brady obligation to provide evidence to a defendant in order for that person to mount their defense effectively. Last fall, the Department of Justice and the FBI said, we've already given you everything we have. There's thousands of pages of documents. There's nothing more to get. So then he asked for a state judge to order them to comply. And lo and behold, before the day that the oral argument were supposed to be held, we hear that all of a sudden the feds are turning over a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm told that it could be as much as 10 terabytes or more of data from that investigation, which also sort of bleeds over into other places, primarily into the Jeremy Johnson case that's being prosecuted right now in federal court. So maybe they didn't really give everything they had. So Troy filed a motion asking to vacate the hearing, and then they've reset a conversation with the judge on March 4th to talk about the scope of what they've received. They're going to run into a couple of problems, I think, as Jeremy Johnson's has, in that from that evidence, there is a huge swath of email that is missing, something like 2 years of information and email conversations back and forth between Johnson and his defense attorneys, which is missing. So we'll see what challenges that may provide. John Swallow's attorney is also interested in this evidence. He's gone after it through a different route. He's asked a judge, the same judge, actually, to order the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office to turn it over to him. They have so far said that it's not necessary for their case and they weren't going to seek it. But I am sort of watching to see if now that it's becoming more readily available, they're going to jump in and try to also get it just to be sure that they're not missing anything. I mean, it would be bad for a prosecution if there's something in there that could change the course of, you know, the case.
How confident are you that this case is going to be going before a judge this year?
Not confident at all. I mean, I think the volume of evidence will take a time to go through. And so I would, you know, Swallow had a trial set for April. That's already been canceled because he got a new attorney, and that's not uncommon. Shurtleff set for trial in May. I can't see any scenario in which either one of them have a trial this year.
Yeah, we're looking at, especially if there's 10 terabytes of information or anywhere near that much information.
That's conservative estimate.
For the defense attorneys to go through that, make some sort of sense of it. And, you know, we're looking at now 18 months, I believe, since they were charged initially back in July of 2014. And we're going to probably be looking at another a year at least before we see a trial. And so justice moves slowly, I guess.
Yeah, I would say that's not really unusual for lots of high profile, complicated cases, for white collar cases, even some murder cases, which you think would be a lot more straightforward, take many, many months to sort of sort through and negotiate. And there's a lot at stake here. And also, I think part of what is happening with Troy Rawlings looking for this evidence is he has clearly in court papers and in stories that we've reported is looking at expanding the scope of his investigation to see if there aren't other people who aren't also haven't also done things that are questionable and may need to be prosecuted. So
stay tuned. We're following this every step of the way.
I sort of feel like I'm going to die writing this story, which it could happen.
Let's turn to the environment. A couple of big stories this week. A well-known author and environmentalist attended an oil and gas auction and came away with some land. Rachel, what were Terry Tempest Williams' intentions going into this auction?
Well, she didn't end up pulling a DeChristopher. She was actually warned against doing that. BLM official came up to her and said, you know, if you raise your paddle, you're going to go to jail. So she waited until after the auction. It's something that actually anyone can do after after an auction of these oil and gas leases. Any parcels that aren't sold are then sold kind of at their minimum cost, which is $1.50 an acre. And so she went to the BLM office right in downtown Salt Lake City, found a parcel kind of near where she and her husband live, and purchased it for $1.50 an acre, about $1,200 all told. She has that land for 10 years. And sort of the restrictions there is that she has to use it for energy production. And, you know, Terry Tempest Williams isn't going to put an oil rig in the ground. She's saying she's going to use that land to fuel the movement of Keep It in the Ground, which basically calls for an end to fossil fuel.
So this is all legal.
Yeah.
Okay. So she doesn't have to face a judge. She bought the land fair and square.
Nope. She bought it fair and square. And, you know, she teaches a class up at the U. She says she's going to bring her students out to that land and you know, use it to educate.
So drilling is not it's not a condition of the sale.
Right. Energy, and they, you know, they have some restrictions on energy development, but she says you cannot define energy.
So. What did the BLM make of all of this? I mean, has there been this kind of protest before?
Well, I mean, of course, Tim DeChristopher famously bid I think it was 2008, and he was sort of a different case because he didn't have the money in hand, and so they said that his only goal was disrupting the auction, where Terry Tempest Williams, you know, had the money, she pulled out her checkbook, was able to pay it. Tim DeChristopher was sort of driving up the costs. But yeah, I think it's pretty rare for someone just to waltz into the BLM office and buy some land who's not a company, basically.
Mm-hmm. And Williams is encouraging others to look at this as an option. Yeah. I mean, is this going to fundamentally change the way protests look on land auctions?
It could. I mean, it'll be interesting to see if more people show up to the next one with the intention of bidding and purchasing.
Another story, you can find it on the front page of this morning's Tribune. Brian Maffley spent yesterday in Richfield at a meeting about grazing rights, and he heard plenty of complaints from ranchers. What's on their minds?
Well, the allegation is that, you know, grazing rights and allotments and production has really fallen since 1950. And there, you know, I think a lot of people would say that there are different causes for this. There's, you know, a bigger agriculture sector that's not just on the backs of farmers anymore. Their specific complaint is with the BLM sort of making it harder to graze cattle and having more restrictions on how they use the public land. So it's gotten pretty intense. There were 400 or 500 people at this meeting yesterday, and you know, various complaints were raised, even about hunting and overpopulation of elk, and you know, a lack of communication and help from the federal land agencies.
And it is a pretty tense time in the context of public lands debate.
Yes.
The arrest of Cliven Bundy, the armed confrontation in Oregon. State officials were at the meeting as well. Mm-hmm. What was their message?
Tony Rampton, who is at the AG's office, he's you know, he's no environmentalist. He's no liberal rabble-rouser, but he was there saying, you know, I'm on your side. I think you have legitimate complaints, but this is not the way to go about it. Don't rip up your grazing allotments. If you do that, you're basically handing a Christmas present to environmentalists, because they can then kick you off your land, and then all that land goes to, you know, this water conservation group. So he said, you know, don't do it this way. I'm with you, but don't mess up your lives by doing this and following these people who do not have your interests in heart. And he was heckled. So it was pretty interesting.
Certainly an issue that we will continue to follow closely. Before we head to a break, Robert, we are at the midpoint of the state legislature. What are the bills, I don't know, four or five that you're watching pretty closely?
Well, we're going to see some Medicaid reform, Medicaid expansion, probably a baby step from Representative Dunnigan covering the very, very poor people in the state. We're going to get budget numbers on Monday. That's sort of the next big milestone, so we can kind of actually start putting the budget together and seeing where the money's going to go. There are a few tax proposals out there that are going to be kind of interesting, the e-cigarette tax being one of them. And then, you know, as we sort of, yeah, well, we'll see some resolution this week or next, I guess, to the medical marijuana and possibly the hate crimes legislation and also the death penalty bill that we didn't talk about. Senator Urquhart's trying to repeal the death penalty.
Yeah, and that came out yesterday.
That came out yesterday, and it'll be kind of moving forward as we go. So, you know, and as the session, you know, the first part of the session's kind of the prelude, you know, we work into it nice and easy, and then the last half of it gets to be pretty chaotic and fast-paced. So there will be other stuff that we're, you know, probably haven't even seen yet that will turn into big issues down the stretch.
And the gloves tend to come off.
Yeah, they do. It gets a little heated.
Okay. We're talking about Utah's top stories. We will be right back after another break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
On the next American Radio Works documentary.
Did you feel prepared to be a teacher?
Ooh, no.
What does it take to be a good teacher, and how can those skills be taught?
Our goal is that it wouldn't be true anymore, that you could just end up with a teacher who's, this is her year to have a rec year.
Listen for Teaching Teachers from APM.
Join us Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Logan Regional Hospital Nutrition Services, helping people live a healthier life through programs directed to prevent diabetes and heart disease. Information at loganregional.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Time for our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. And Rachel, do you want to kick us off? What you got?
Sure. It's a story that it's in our paper today. There's a bill at the legislature that's gotten some support. It sounds good on the surface. It basically says, you know, when we make rules regulating water, they should go through a peer review. You know, science, check them out. Make sure that they're good. The criticism of this is that it requires anyone who wants to have a rule peer reviewed would have to pay for all the costs. They'd have to be holding a water permit, and there's some other restriction. But basically, it would sort of eliminate, you know, the average Joe from doing this and put that power in the hands of someone who would, you know, be the owner of a water treatment plant, who could then say, like, do I really need to install this $1 million pollution thing, you know, or can I just keep my lead pipes, you know? And the EPA, which rarely sort of steps into issues like this, wrote a letter earlier this month and said, if you pass this as it is, you're going to be in violation of the Federal Clean Water Act, and that could eventually trigger the EPA coming into Utah, taking over the Division of Water Quality, and setting up shop here and making all the rules. So that would not make very many people happy. So it'll be interesting to see how this progresses.
Okay. Again, if you haven't read that, sltrib.com is the place to find it. Jennifer Dobner, what's your pick?
This week I actually have a pick.
Good for you.
And it's another legislative and criminal justice related issue. Senate Bill 155 from Todd Weiler, a Republican out of Woods Cross. It's a proposal to establish a commission to oversee Utah's Indigent Defense Fund. Utah's been widely criticized for the way it handles indigent defense, underpaid public defenders, lack of resources to handle cases adequately. And he's proposing $3 million to set up a mechanism for, you know, looking at contracts and making sure that people are getting what they're constitutionally due, which is, you know, adequate representation. So it's advanced from a Senate committee, and we'll see where it goes.
Okay.
There's some frustration with that bill because the $3 million price tag is not anywhere near what is needed to address the problem. But I think this is, Todd sees this as a first step to try to get it done. They spent a long time studying it, and so they've got laying the groundwork for it. I guess my underplayed story, I guess, is one that will actually be out tomorrow. We've written a little bit about it before. I think Brian did a story during the week. But Representative Mike Noel has a proposal that's in committee today to manage the public lands that Utah is going to receive from the federal government when it receives them from the federal government. It's not if in his mind. So once the state receives 100,000 acres of land, this is how it's going to be managed, according to Representative Noel. And so this sort of, you know, this is sort of the rubber meets the road. You know, it downplays sort of the environmental protection side of it, and plays up, I guess, the energy production side of it, something that I think the legislature will like. It's in committee today. I suspect it'll pass, and you can read about it tomorrow in the Tribune.
Okay. My pick is going to be an item from Paul Raleigh. He says that the Koch brothers, those conservative bastions that seem to be very involved in national politics, are coming to a city near you, and they are campaigning at the Salt Lake County Council level. And we will see how far they go into local politics. That seems something new, Robert.
Well, yeah, they've had this AFP, which was active in defeating the Proposition 1, the transit tax ballot measure, and they, you know, and they're right now they're opposing the online sales tax. So they've been involved in local policy issues, and now I guess are wading into campaign issues as well.
Very interesting to watch. Robert Gerke, Jennifer Dobner, and Rachel Piper of the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much, everyone, for your time today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. You too. We're going to wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. And this week, Kirby remembers being a political outsider as a kid.
Most of my friends' parents were really conservative, and oddly enough, mine weren't. My friends' parents supported Barry Goldwater, and my parents wanted Lyndon Johnson to win. And so they would capitalize on the fact that this was a very conservative neighborhood, and they would go up to the door and say, "Ghost for Goldwater," and they would get extra candy. I couldn't quite bring myself to lie about it, especially since my dad helped make my costume.
Well, you remembered one Halloween, and you wrote about it in a column from
2008.
Do you want to read a bit?
Yeah. My friend's name was Bobby. We were both Bobbies. Bobby's parents were ardent supporters of Barry Goldwater. He insisted that hollering "Ghosts for Goldwater," rather than the more conventional trick-or-treat, would increase our haul. My political views at the time were influenced entirely by a pretty good idea that my father would hang me by my feet in the garage for a month if I supported Goldwater. He was a solid Lyndon Johnson man. Though widely considered a moron, this time Bobby was right. Her neighborhood proved to be a Republican stronghold. House after house rewarded the "Ghost for Goldwater" cry with extra candy. The success soon drew other kids. "And what about that kid there with his head sticking out of the box?" people would ask. "Is he for Goldwater, too?" I have to stop here and tell you that my costume that year was I was a headstone. Because it would get back to my father, I had to confess that I wasn't. I would then receive a token offering. Sometimes it was nothing at all. The other kids started calling me Lyndon Box Johnson. It was my first experience with the ugliness of political pressure.
What do you think about this year's presidential campaigning?
Well, I'm not terribly impressed, frankly. I think we're seeing a phenomenon, though, at least in New Hampshire, where the upset by Trump and by Sanders, these two dark horses that began running, and suddenly they're no longer a joke because they might actually win, is the result of Americans being sick and tired of a two-party system that has brought us to where we are today. We've heard the same thing for the last 100 years, and we've got to come up with a third party or something that speaks more to Americans.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. You can read all of his opinions on the website, 20-plus years of archives at sltrib.com. That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams and Bennett Purser at UPR, and Emily Means from the Tribune. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Donald Trump is leading in South Carolina, and former Republican Governor Mark Sanford can't believe it.
I can't figure it out. Other than to say people's frustrations with Washington and how it doesn't work for them is really boiling hard.
Mark Sanford on the campaign and his past and future next time on Here and Now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Touch with Fire is a love story about two poets with bipolar disorder, played by Katie Holmes and Luke Kirby. Next time on Q, I'll speak with the film's director, Paul Dalio, about how his own mental health struggles shaped the film. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
Join us this afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio. Public Radio.
This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, KUSUFM HD1 91.5 Logan.